This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. I want you to think about the phone calls you've made over the past week, the ones you've received as well. How many were on a landline, or was it pretty much all done on your mobile phone? Do you even have a landline anymore? Whether it's a personal call for your business or calling emergency services, pretty much most of it is done nowadays on a mobile. But the telcos in Australia have had no obligation to provide mobile phone coverage. The universal service obligation only covers landlines and payphones to ensure all Australians have access to voice calls. But now that's changing. After a major election promise, the federal government has released draft legislation for the universal outdoor mobile obligation, alongside its awaited response to the 2024 Regional Telecommunications Review. So what this actually means, though, is that outdoor coverage will be accessible almost anywhere Australians can see the sky. It's going to require mobile phone carriers to provide reasonable access to mobile voice and text outdoors almost everywhere in Australia. Curious to hear your thoughts on this today. You can send me a text on 0487 993222. Do you think this will make a big difference or not? Well, National Farmers Federation Telecommunications Committee Chair Peter Thompson says the universal outdoor mobile obligation must guarantee reliable and affordable connectivity as it's vital to the safety and productivity of people in regional and rural communities.
What's been put forward by the government sounds really good on the surface, but as we've said right from day one, the devil would be in the detail. And unfortunately, there is still very little detail there. So what we're really looking for is reliable and affordable and usable mobile phone capability. And there's various things that need to happen for that to be a reality. And part of it is some government support and legislation to ensure it happens. And unfortunately, we still don't have anything really concrete other than a commitment that something will be done about it.
Anyone in regional Victoria or Australia will know some of the challenges of the mobile networks in regional areas. What are some of the horror stories that you've heard in your position?
I mean, I'm literally driving through some horror stories today. So I'm not far out of Dolby in the central Darling Downs. One of the big issues that's happened after the 3G, 4G switchover, another thing that's come into play that a lot of people we didn't know about it or didn't expect was at the same time, there's a lot of 5G upgrading. I did have an iPhone 12 and have just upgraded to a 16 to try and overcome some of the issues that everyone else is facing with the best way to describe it in layman's terms is the interference between 4G and 5G. So there's a lot of places here on the Downs where line of sight, et cetera, everything should be right, good phone signal. And in fact, I was talking to NFF headquarters this morning and both of us dropped out and I had four bars of signal strength. So that's the level of unreliability and unpredictability. That's just one small example.
In addition to it being a bit of a pain, there's also some real issues around productivity and safety for people in regional communities too, isn't there?
Yeah, so in our case, we live 80 kilometres north of Roma in southern inland Queensland. We've got, due to the coal seam gas expansion around our area, we've actually got three mobile phone towers that are within 16 kilometres of our main homestead. So on our property, some of it's only 4 or 5 kilometres away. And pre all of the switchover, we basically had, certainly with car kits and boosters and you name it, we had reliable both phone and data connectivity. Now we've got lots of areas where there isn't, or one day it'll work, another it doesn't. So, you know, it's, and like many people, it's sort of moved away from UHF radios and we're tending to use the mobile phone much more. What's happening is, to give us some safety redundancy, many people are going back to adding the UHF radio into their vehicle, or the one that, you know, someone can wear when mustering or something like that. And it's just, we've really have had a significant backward step in basic telecommunications, even though over the last number of years we've had some big advances in the, the data capability. But it's a footprint, and reliability of the footprint of that capability is a really big issue.
Telecommunications companies do have obligations of a certain level of service. The government said that they're going to put tougher penalties in place. How much hope do you have in that process?
To be totally honest, not a lot as it stands. And that's the sort of thing that we were wanting to see in the UOMO, was something that really does give teeth to the, the situation. The other thing is that we've got the advent of, in fact, today I've just purchased two Starlink minis, because I've got to the point of, I've done everything I can with the current technology and still barely back to, or even not back to where we were before. That's a huge expense to outlay. It's big expense for us, and for some people it's, those two Starlinks, it's about $1,200 nearly, after having spent $2,500 on upgrading my phone a few weeks ago. And this is the sort of thing that I just don't think people outside of the rural and regional areas fully will comprehend, just how much money people are trying to spend, people are having to spend to try and get the connectivity that's needed for today's, whether it's a farming or a grazing operation, or just simply safety of connectivity.
What's your message to government, and what's your message to the telecommunications company today?
It's a really simple one, and that is just please listen to what we're putting forward. Everyone within the RRR areas, rural, regional, remote areas, are putting forward very simple requests, and it's about, we don't expect to have exactly the same as city areas, but we certainly believe that we are entitled to a reliable, affordable, basic communications package. And for that to happen, we just need really good engagement and understanding from government and from telcos. But beyond that, we actually need action on that understanding. So two-step process: we need the understanding, we need the connection, we need the understanding, and then we need the action.
That's National Farmers Federation Telecommunications Committee Chair Peter Thompson speaking to Jane McNaughton. What do you want to see covered in the universal outdoor mobile obligation? Just text and calls on mobiles, or do you think anything else should be added? You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. But also, if you do feel quite strongly about this one, consultation is open on this draft legislation. So if you want to actually have your say to government as well, you can head online and just search for Universal Outdoor Mobile Obligation Consultation, and you can have your say as well. Head online. It is 14 minutes past 12. Up next, farmers want to be able to keep shooting flying foxes. And I'll bring you the details on that next.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. Join us for local news and community happenings. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Queensland farmers fear they could lose millions of dollars worth of crops if they're unable to shoot flying foxes. So damage mitigation permit, Permits which allow the shooting are going to be phased out from July next year. However, some growers are hopeful of a pause or a reversal as the state's environment minister considers industry feedback. Taylor Larson has this story.
Every night from 7 o'clock until 11 o'clock, we'd go out and patrol. Three quad bikes and go out and patrol and keep the flying foxes out. Every night from the middle of November to the end of January. And that's the way we save our crop. Otherwise, we potentially, if I lost my whole crop, there'd be millions of dollars every year.
Visitors driving onto Craig Van Royen's property are greeted by a flying fox fortress. Floodlights surround a 10-hectare netting structure designed to protect his lychee orchard just outside of Bundaberg, 370 kilometres north of Brisbane.
There's some years there that we probably had $70,000, $80,000 worth of damage because they will land on top of the drape netting and they will chew through the nets.
Mr Van Royen has spent more than $2 million on non-lethal control measures but says that's still not enough and shooting permits are crucial.
We're only trying to control them for 2 months of the year. So it's only the early arrivals. If you knock out three or four of the early arrivals, the next day or the next 3 or 4 days, you might get nothing. But if you don't, the next day you've got 10. Then if you don't control those 10, then after that you've got 30 or 40, then you've got hundreds and then you lose control.
In Queensland, all flying fox species are protected, so it's illegal to shoot them without a permit. But from July next year, damage mitigation permits, which allow primary producers to shoot a limited number of flying foxes for crop protection, will no longer be available. The previous state Labor government began a phase-out of the program in July 2023 and slashed the lethal take quota by up to 90%. It gave landholders 3 years to adapt new control measures, and as a result, the number of animal deaths has dropped by more than 75% in that time.
When the orchards and the fruits are flowering is the time that the grey-headed and the blacks and the spectacles have their babies. So most of the 70% of the animals being shot are mothers, and they usually are either pregnant or have their babies on board. They carry their babies.
That's Melinda Brennan, President of Bat Conservation and Rescue Queensland. She's eager for the permits to be repealed and says shooting is inhumane.
From our experience, it has been determined that it is not successful. Hungry bats will always try and go back, and they tend to only go into these orchards when there's some sort of food event with the natural forest. The really only true humane control measure is full hail guard netting. It is expensive, we acknowledge that, but full exclusion netting is the only humane and effective way of protecting the fruit crops from not just flying foxes, but also from rats, possums, birds and some insects. And also it has the benefit of protecting their crops against hail.
Currently, farmers can only apply for a permit if they've held one previously and have two non-lethal measures like lights and nets in place. There are government loans to help purchase deterrent devices, and while some can't get insurance for their netting structures, eligible landholders can apply for assistance following a declared disaster event. Even with this additional assistance, Mr Van Royen says he's exhausted his options.
I should be able to protect my workers against being bitten or scratched by a flying fox. Now, if they ban the shooting of flying foxes and I can't get a person from wherever they come from, a wildlife ranger, to come and, I don't know, take them away somehow in amongst, I've got 12,000 trees. Good luck trying to catch those flying foxes. But are you telling me, government, are telling me that I have to stop 120 workers and potentially put them in harm's way because I'm not allowed to keep them safe?
Queensland Environment Minister Andrew Powell has been meeting with industry for feedback. Some growers, like Mr Van Royen, are hopeful of a reversal of the phase-out.
Everything needs a balance, and this is a balanced approach. You have to have a whole lot of non-lethal methods in place, and then you can take out occasional early arrivals. It is a responsible thing to do, and those permits should remain in place so that I can protect my staff, protect my crop, put money back into the community through wages.
A spokesperson from the state government says their input is under consideration and current arrangements will continue while extensive community consultation is conducted.
Taylor Larson with that report. Now, if you want to see some of the measures Mr. Van Rooyen is taking, or if you want to learn more about this story, you can head online to abc.net.au/rural and you can check out more on that story. Now, a text has come through on our earlier story about the universal mobile obligation. Chris said that we live in rural, 30 kilometres from Bundaberg. Our signal is nearly now non-existent on a 300-acre farm. It's a real safety issue as mobile switched from emergency to 4G. And he said, if injured, who would think to lock on emergency only? Maybe two cans and a string would be better. Thank you so much for your text, Chris. And if you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can. You can send me a text on 0487 993 222.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Weather's up next, but first, it might sound like something out of a superhero movie. Workers are trading white coats for power suits, but it's not fiction. In abattoirs across the nation, the Australian Meat Processor Corporation is trialling exoskeletons, which is wearable technology designed to ease the strain of repetitive work. Brandon Long caught up with Chris Fitzgerald, who is an ergonomist working on the trial, to see how workers are putting these futuristic suits to the test, including one named the Iron Hand.
The meat industry has got specific needs. It's very manual, so the level of automation and semi-automation is still quite low. So you've got a whole workforce. You've got the complexity of getting workforce and retaining them into the industry. And so the nationality range, we heard presenters this morning saying there's at least 50 different nationalities in most plants, which is remarkable. And those nationalities bring different sizes, strengths, short, big, tall, and they're all still doing mostly manual work. There's a lot of bending and moving. The work itself is inherently repetitive because it's process work. Most lamb processing, sheep processing, they'll process one every 6 seconds or so. With beef, it's probably closer to once a minute. And so, it's repetitive. There's not a lot of relief from that.
And whereabouts in the production line would this most be beneficial?
Pretty much wherever you've got high hand force exertion in terms of gripping the tool or gripping parts of a carcass or a cut of meat or repetitively, and also where you might be bending down a lot or sustaining a slightly inclined posture or reaching above your shoulder height.
Are there any processes that you know that already have this technology, or is it still early days and you're still working out where it fits?
Yeah, it's still early days, and I was approached by the AMPC about 3 years ago to review some devices, and I've done a lot of project work and small-scale design work with them over 20 years. And I had jumped online and I could see this was taking off globally. So I proposed back to them, I said, rather than assess individual devices as they're marketed to the industry, why don't we get ahead of the industry's needs, run a project, see what's available globally, define what the industry needs from these devices, and so that by the time more and more of these devices are presented or become available, we're quite articulate as an industry about what we need. So you can head it off at the pass if it's completely irrelevant to your needs.
Are there any countries that are leading the way in this area?
I think in the States the uptake is appearing to be strong. I think in some European countries, and part of that's based on, in particularly France and Sweden and Germany, they have manufacturers and developers of these devices, so they've been able to move into those industries. But a lot of those, like say in Germany, it's automotive building, so it's a clean environment, it's highly predictable, whereas the meat industry, it's a wet environment, you're dealing with carcasses and parts of a carcass. It's much more complex.
So this is looking after the meat worker's body as well as potentially increasing productivity?
Our priority is the people doing the work. So to try and reduce physical demands and reduce their risk of injury and improve their comfort. I have some people at the end of the day saying, oh, normally I'm feeling a bit sore and stiff at the end of the day, but I'm not today. And so it's primarily about the benefits to the individual, but that will then be cumulative back to the organisation.
Yeah, less days off, less time spent at physio or the doctors or wherever it may be.
100%, yeah. Okay. 100%.
Well, let's take a little look at this device then. So Chris has just fitted me with a backpack-looking device. We have lots of electronics. We've got a glove here that's connected to a cable. Run me through what exactly I'm wearing right now. Yeah,
so this is truly a revolutionary device. So it's called the Iron Hand Glove, and essentially along the side of each of the fingers and the thumbs, there are these fine cables, like fishing wire, and they then all gather together at the base of the heel to form a single, like a core, and then that extends to a device, which is like a tortoiseshell device. Those cables end in a plate, and they connect to the device, so there's hooks that go into that plate and they move those, they pull those cables in a certain way. And also in that sort of tortoiseshell device is the smart. So it's a computer and it's responding to the way the various force sensors in each of the digits and the thumb and the base of the thumb, how they are activated is how the glove will behave.
So what's the main processing power here? How does it all work?
So within the glove, as I said, there's sensors in the tips of each digit and the base of the thumb. Mm-hmm. And I can configure the glove to say if I push the sensor at the base of the thumb, which is typical if I grab a tool, mm-hmm. I can say, well, I want the fingers, all the fingers to flex. Or I might say, I want three of the fingers to flex.
And is that done on software via a tablet?
Correct. So I've got a tablet device here. I've connected you, essentially. I've got, I'm looking at a graphic now of the hand or the glove, and it's showing me each of the sensors. And I can now say, I want, if I... the thumb contacts is contacted by an object, then I can make the, I can say I want to flex the first finger. I can then say how much force I want to exert, between 0 and 100%, so as a percentage of your maximum capacity. I can say how sensitively I want those sensors to activate. Because we're working in the meat industry, people normally have at least two gloves. One's a cut-resistant glove or a mesh glove, and then a waterproof glove. So I set the sensitivity settings really high.
So we've got the glove here. We'll
yeah, this won't hurt a bit.
Well, okay, so, feeling a little bit like Iron Man at the moment.
Well, it's the only of these devices that not only is like... It's a soft wearable, it conforms to the shape of your hand, but it actually gives us data. So all these sensors, and the data's phenomenal. So I'll ask a meat worker, which fingers do you hold the knife? And they'll say the thumb and the forefinger. And I'm saying, well, that's not going to work because it's a lever. It's applying force through the blade. The little finger and the ring finger is going to be working a lot harder. And when we see the data, the ring finger, the little finger and ring finger are working just as hard as the thumb. And then people come back and say, oh, I didn't realise how much my little finger was working. So I can get data that says how many repetitions in a given time, what proportion of contribution to force exertion the glove made versus not having that force assistance. And there's even some of the reports out of that data can give me a risk rating in terms of the probability of some sort of injury occurring with that part of the body. I'm always conservative, so I'm going to bring you up to a 50% value. So I want you to start. So you've got a tube. It's about 30 mil diameter. Start squeezing it. Can you start feeling the...
Yes.
Hear the device sort of operating behind you.
Yes, right.
Yeah. So you should get a sense that when you start to grip that, it's actually helping you finish that grip. And then if you hold it, it'll help you lock that into place.
Mm. Is there, you know, no Final Destination movie type of scenario where things could go pear-shaped?
There is a risk, a very low risk. So there's a safety device. So you've got a control unit, which is, you know, the size of a small mobile phone. And then there's a red sort of part of that. If you pulled down on that, that would just turn the device off. If you
don't, it's a very bizarre feeling, isn't it?
Yeah,
okay. Right.
And so I see this as being applicable to people doing high or frequent grip force exertion, but I've also been putting it on people with existing injuries. So in the meat industry, and as with any industry where you're doing physical work, a proportion of your workforce is going to have some sort of either ache or pain, niggling pain, and that's well represented in the meat industry. So I've been very conservatively and with consent testing it on people, and it's just miraculous. So I'll have people with who've had lacerated tendons in their fingers. They say, "This is my hand feels normal." I've had people with various sort of tendonitis or tennis elbow issues who've used it for 3 or 4 hours. They had no symptoms. When they take it off, they say, "Oh well, that's my pain level zero." 10 minutes later, they don't use it. Their symptoms reactivate.
So this is a conservative setting. So what happens if we change it up a little bit?
I need to get you to sign consent for that. No, I don't. So I'll ramp you up to 75%. So if you just keep compressing that. So I've just pressed the base of the thumb sensor, and your hand reacts into a grip force.
That's bizarre, isn't it?
That's completely weird. Yeah. But that's a good demonstration of how it works.
Yeah. So what kind of reactions do you get when people try this on for the first time?
Well, it's always quizzical. It's quite novel. That's okay at the outset, but we quickly get into business and apply it. The best result is when people don't want to give it back to you.
When do we think that we'll see commercial reality? So I'd imagine they wouldn't be cheap.
No, they're not cheap. So I think probably when we purchased two sets of these 3 years ago, and that was like $50,000 Australian, so about 25 a set. I'm not sure if that, I think it's come down a little bit in price, and also you'd be very specific about your application, so you wouldn't need to get all the bits. I think the uptake will be strong.
Chris Fitzgerald is the Chief Executive of Risk and Injury Management Services, speaking with Brandon Long. Had another text come through on the universal mobile obligation. They said, "We have a small block about 5 kilometres outside of Gundawindi and have no mobile reception at all." They said, "It's a disgrace that rural and remote residents have spotty or no reception, and that telcos should be held to account to maintain the existing landlines and have reliable mobile reception." Thank you so much for your text today. If you want to have your say, you can on 0487 993 222. You can send me a text anytime. Well, weather is up next. Then the risk of fires in Western Queensland is actually higher this year due to the rain from earlier, sort of in that March-April period.
Detective Jay Swan rides into a new town and starts digging.
Ready or not, here I come.
The acclaimed series returns, Mystery Road Origin, Sunday nights on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Time to check in on the weather, and Liam Smart joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Liam.
Good afternoon, Megan. How's it going?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Lovely sunny day for most of Queensland we've got. With the sunny day for most of Queensland, you've got the eastern part of Queensland, though quite a few clouds about. Got a few thunderstorms as well in the forecast from areas pretty much east of Barcald and all the way to the coast and down to the Sunshine Coast, with the possibility of some severe thunderstorms between, say, about Bilawila and Gympie. So when I say severe thunderstorms, they're the kind of storms that can pack those damaging wind gusts of greater than 90 kilometres an hour, and some possibility of some large hail as well.
Yeah, so is it quite a small area that could be impacted?
Yeah, it's a small area, mostly confined to the eastern parts of the Wide Bay Burnett, maybe peeking out into the southern parts of the Capricornia. Those storms will be isolated, but do keep an eye out on those warnings just in case.
Are there particular locations, particular towns that should keep this in mind?
Yeah, so currently we've got some storms around Maryborough. They're not existing, in any severe state at the moment, but we are keeping an eye on those. So, yeah, pretty much if you're in the areas between Maryborough, Bundaberg, maybe, say Bilawila, sort of anywhere between that area is more the risk zone that we're looking at for the severe thunderstorms. Otherwise, broad area of like the Central Highlands and Coalfields and the Wide Bay and Burnett should see probably a thunderstorm here or there.
And is there much rainfall in those systems?
Not really expecting too much rainfall. There's not too much moisture in the atmosphere to produce that today. We could see maybe 10 to 15 millimetres at best out of some of these thunderstorms. As I say, thunderstorms are very hit and miss today, so you may receive something, you may not. It's just kind of like popcorn.
Mm.
Popping in. pop. It's the best way I can describe a good old isolated thunderstorm.
Yeah. Now, heading away from that sort of Wide Bay and Capricornia area down to the Darling Downs Granite Belt, is there anything happening in the south?
Nothing happening in the south at the moment. It's pretty much going to be a sunny period for the next few days. Overnight temperatures will be a little bit lower than average over the next couple of mornings, with the possibility for some frost in the Granite Belt on Wednesday morning. But otherwise, pretty much clear for most of the week down that part of the state.
And what about in the west?
Out in the west, so we do have some high fire dangers out in the west at the moment, particularly in the far northwest. Those fire dangers will then start pushing into the central interior, right the way through again into the Capricornia and the central and the central coast, and maybe even the Wide Bay. But as those temperatures sort of stay around the mid-30s for the middle of the week and the winds start picking up, and then come the end of the week, temperatures will really start to pick up, with the potential for even a 40 degrees out in the Gulf Country.
Yeah, so really getting into those sort of hotter days as we're coming more into summer now.
Yeah, exactly. So summer is starting to peek its head around the corner, which is lovely for me. I do personally love the warm weather. I'm a little bit over the cold. But as for a lot of your listeners, there's a lot to look out for in the summer, especially when it comes to severe weather. So always keep an eye on our forecast that we've got going, especially with the fire dangers and the increased plant life that's come out there because of the floods earlier on this year.
Now, in regards to these western sort of high fire dangers, is there strong winds associated this week with them?
There are some strong winds. They're not the strongest of winds that we can see out there with some high pressures, but as we have a ridge moving over, that pressure gradient does start to increase. So we are seeing some a little bit of an increase, which is bringing those high fire dangers along with it, probably in the, you know, the 30 to 40 kilometre hour marks at most, probably.
And in the north of the state, what's this week looking like?
Far north of the state, you're going to have some showers about, particularly along the North Tropical Coast. They'll probably last until maybe Wednesday, possibly pushing into Thursday. But up into the peninsula, that rainfall is really dropping off. And then come Friday, most of the state will be rain-free. Those temperatures up north will be around the mid-30s for pretty much the whole week. No storms on the horizon there, though.
And in the terms of the coastal forecast, how are sort of swells and winds looking?
So as the today's a pretty okay day out on the waters. Tomorrow we do have a strong wind warning out for the southeast Gulf waters. And then as the ridge starts building throughout the middle of the week, we are seeing some strong wind warnings, particularly off the Cooktown and Peninsula coast. Also worth noting that down in the southeast, anywhere south of Gurry may also have a strong wind warning out on waters down there as well, especially as that ridge starts to bring in some stronger southeasterlies.
Liam, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Liam Smart, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
It's Jonathan Agnew.
And Alison Mitchell here. The England cricket team's looking sharp and they're ready to take on the Aussies in the battle for the Ashes.
Grab the ABC Listen app and get ready for the summer of cricket with ABC Sport. Catch every ball on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
You really do know you're heading into summer when you start hearing cricket promos on the radio as well. But as this summer and as the temperatures are heating up, there's a lot more focus on this bushfire season, which kicked off in August. So the Rural Fire Service says the Central West has a greater risk of bushfires this summer due to increased fuel loads. Area manager Fiona Quirk is urging landholders to take extra precautions and says time is running out for hazard reduction burns to take place safely. She tells Madeline McCosker an increased fuel load means there's a greater risk for bushfires over the summer.
We're just coming into the bushfire season and, of course, we're always concerned, but there are higher fuel loadings around this year and we do have land managers taking precautions of putting in brakes, doing hazard reduction burns and just burning along the highways to mitigate the chance of escaped fires in the bushfire season.
And Fiona, just talk to me about fuel loads across the West. How do they play into the risk associated with bushfires? And what are we looking at the moment in terms of risk in this area?
So with the fuel loadings, we do have more vegetation on the ground than what we've had in previous years. And we've had two or three good seasons over the past couple of years, and that's just increased the amount of vegetation on the ground, which in turn, as it cures or dies off, it becomes more volatile when fire's introduced to it. So that increases the risk of having bigger and better fires.
Yeah, and you mentioned hazard reduction burns. There's been quite a few of those happening around the place the last little while. And one thing we've heard here is that even the fire crews have actually been really surprised by the speed and the ferocity of which those burns are happening because of the fuel loads and I guess the thick pasture. So what can we learn from those hazard reduction burns?
Well, what we can learn is that our season's going to probably be bigger than what we normally have, and we just need to be prepared. So property owners need to make sure that they've got their equipment in order, ready to go if it's needed, that they've got any fire breaks or fire trails in place, and that they've got essential infrastructure well protected. If any landholders are wanting to do hazard reduction burning, they need to get a permit to light fire to do that. For anything bigger than 2 by 2 by 2 metres, you require a permit to light fire. They are free, available from your local fire warden or contact our office.
And you just said earlier that, you know, this year the risk is probably more serious than in previous years because of the amount of feed that we do have around. In terms of, I guess, the staffing or volunteers that you have and equipment, how are you faring in that space? Do you feel like you've got enough to be prepared to cover off for this fire season?
Oh, we could always use more volunteers, but the ones that we have are doing their best to be as prepared as they can. The Central West area has just recently had an injection of staff, and most of those staff are out and about daily with our volunteers checking equipment and making sure that they are ready.
How frequently should we be looking at maybe doing those burns to really get ahead of the situation?
We're probably getting to the end of the period where it's going to be safe to do, because you want to do it in the cooler months when there's not a lot of wind. There is quite a bit happening at the moment, but I can see in the next 4 to 6 weeks, if we don't get further rain, that window will be closing. Once the weather deteriorates, once it heats up and we get windy, you won't be able to do any hazard reduction burning because of the risk of it escaping.
Inspector Fiona Quirk, the Central West Area Manager for Rural Fire Services, speaking with Madeline McCosker. It is 17 minutes to one. Up next, I'll introduce you to one of the new Nuffield Scholars who's based near Townsville and wants to develop Australia's Red Claw aquaculture industry.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Thank you for your company today. If you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. Well, the 2026 Nuffield Scholarship recipients have been announced, and there was a couple in there from Queensland. So if you don't know what Nuffield is, basically it's an annual program with the aim to increase practical farming knowledge, business skills and personal capacity development for farmers. And of the 19 selected from across the country, there was one Townsville local among them. Nathan Clearsby is a freshwater crayfish farmer at his company, Living Water Aquaculture, just south of Townsville. He has a background in marine biology, and he hopes to use this scholarship to look at aquaculture techniques around the world that can expand Australia's freshwater crayfish production.
My background is fish farming, so I did a degree in marine science in Sydney and then moved up to North Queensland maybe 12 or 13 years ago to do a master's at James Cook Uni, and then that was in aquaculture, and ever since then I've been working in barramundi farming or prawn farming, algae farming, a little bit of lobster farming, but all based up here in North Queensland.
And so you're a scholarship recipient this year. Tell me a bit about what inspired you to go for that.
Sure. So the Nuffield Scholarship is something that goes out every year, and it's primarily aimed at increasing Australia's agriculture production by exposure to international farming techniques. So it's a fantastic initiative. For me, I'd been watching it for a couple of years, saw other fish farmers that had gone on and done a trip and done that experience, and they gained a lot of information from, you know, countries like China and Southeast Asia have been doing aquaculture for like hundreds of years more than Australia have. So they have very developed systems. So to go over there and see things like that is super beneficial for personal and for business. So I'd watched it, but it's a long time away. It's like 3 months of travelling the world next year, which sounds amazing, but there are commitments we all have at home. So for me, it was a timing thing, like when will it work with the family, with the business, and let's try and see if we can score it that year. And that was this year, so that's lucky.
Yeah. And do you think there is a big gap in the research for particularly like crayfish in Australia?
There certainly is in production. In terms of research, our research is pretty top level. We've got some fantastic unis and really smart people. But our, like, Australia's production of red claw is maybe 30, 50 tonnes a year, not very much, where China will do, like, 500,000 tonne. Like, it's hugely different in production. So to see kind of their strategies and production techniques and how they do it and, all the people involved in post-production and all of that, I think will really benefit the whole industry in North Queensland.
And tell me a bit about your farm. So this is a new venture for you. Mm. When did it all get up and running?
Sure. So we started about 5 years ago. We found red claw, you might not be aware, they're not super common, but they're a delicious product. They're really sustainable to grow. So we're what you call a zero net discharge farm. So no water actually leaves our farm. It all stays there. We use it again and again and again. And there's no fish meal or fish oil. So the common traps for aquaculture we kind of avoid, which I loved, and I love the product. So I was like, all right, why isn't this a bigger species than it is? So did a lot of research, realised a big part of the reason was that there was no commercial seed stock production. So started working with a farm up in Atherton who have been working on the problem for a long time. We collaborated, solved the problem, started supplying seed stock to the industry. And then 3 years ago decided, all right, we've done the technical side, let's do the farming side. So purchased a farm about 30 minutes out of Townsville in 2023. We've developed that to a 5-hectare farm now and are producing and selling into the local market and into like Sydney and Brisbane as well.
And what's that demand been like, particularly locally?
Yeah, really strong. Yeah, we can't keep up. So we regularly, like every week, I'll kind of say, oh, we don't have enough stock until 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time. And kind of now having to pick and choose who we send to. So, yeah, demand is really strong, but production is relatively low. So it'll be interesting to see that interplay as our production increases. But at the moment, yeah, it outstrips what we can do.
Townsville freshwater crayfish farmer and 2026 Nuffield Scholarship recipient Nathan Clisby speaking to Brooke Tindall. Had another text come through on mobile service in the bush. They said that listening to the Country Hour about 6 months ago, a Telstra spokesman said that satellite text messaging would be available to all Telstra customers in remote areas, but they tried doing that in Western Queensland and had no such luck. And they contacted Telstra and found out you need to have a certain model phone to access this and that their phone was not one of these models. They said that I have to upgrade a perfectly good phone to access this service. Thank you for your text. I'll have a look into that one. I think, yeah, that sounds like that's a bit of an issue if everybody, you know, in remote areas is going to have to upgrade their phones to access these services. I'll take you to North Queensland now because Kangrowers is encouraging students to get involved with agriculture by creating competitions around Queensland. Liam McNally visited a school taking part in Mackay's contest to find out what it's all about.
Nestled among sugarcane farms, 15 kilometres south of Mackay, agriculture has been a part of Chelowna State School's culture for more than 130 years. And this year, the students are getting their hands dirty. Teacher Dean Matthews explains how it came about.
The children, ever since I've been here, have been at me about growing sugarcane. It's something they used to do at this school many, many years ago. So kids that have been here for generations, their parents may have grown cane at this school. It's definitely something that will, you know, help out the kids to see that process and see how it a plant can become food and everything. And the resources that cane growers are releasing really help with teaching that. So basically, we have a 2x2 metre plot here that we're going to plant some two varieties of cane. The kids are going to dig the trenches and prepare everything. And over the next 12 months, they're going to tend to the cane and water it and keep it growing. And hopefully at the end, we'll be successful in the competition to have the sweetest cane.
Chelowna's sugar cane is being planted as a part of Mackay Cane Growers' inaugural Sweeter Schools competition. Students will grow their own cane and have it judged at the Mackay show next year. Cane Growers Mackay Communications and Membership Manager Kiralee Lamb says it has been great to see excitement from schools so far.
What we want them to get out of this is a practical science learning and getting that experience of growing something and seeing it go from, you know, a small billet to a big tall piece of cane and really get a sense of the process that's involved in that across the year. We've got 13 schools involved, right out to Gargett, right up to Kaelin, and Chelowna's our most southern school. Across the year they'll get a visit from Sugar Research Australia offices to do some soil science with them. They'll get visits from our MAPS productivity officers and they'll talk about agronomy. And then eventually, when we get to June next year, it will be entered in the show competition and the winning school will be crowned Sweeter School.
Farmer and Cane Growers Mackay board member Bill McDonald will mentor Chelowna through the growing process. He carted cane from his farm just down the road for the school's planting.
It's pretty ironic. My grandma come to this school, so we've been to this school for a long time, so yeah. When I was at this school, it was an agricultural school sort of thing, you know, like most of the kids come from farms. We had a plot just down here in the corner when I was here at school and, yeah, we all had a row of cane to look after sort of thing, so.
What are you up to today?
Just trying to get the kids to start thinking about the sugar industry again. It's been lacking for a lot of years. It's a good idea to get the kids involved and get their dirt under their fingernails and just see how it works, you know. This will be good. They'll be able to watch the plant progress from planting to grow up until bigger cane next year. So, yeah, it should be good.
Queensland Cane Growers Chief Executive Dan Galligan said the initiative comes as a part of a broader push to get young people learning about Australian agriculture, which has also included creating sugar industry-related school curriculum materials.
We can't just hope that people will get older and learn about agriculture anymore, like everybody once upon a time might have had a connection to farms, but we actually need to be proactive as an industry. We've spent the last 3 years developing education materials that are aligned directly to the Queensland curriculum. We've done primary schools and we're just about to release secondary schools education resources that are ready for teachers to use.
Students like Evelyn Silling and Hunter Marshall are happy to learn about their local area in a hands-on way.
Everyone in the Mackay Whitsunday region grows cane and it's nice to know if you happen to walk across it.
And is anyone in your family or do you know anyone outside school that does sugarcane farming?
My family comes from a sugarcane family here.
And so do you ever help out farming outside of school?
Yeah, definitely.
So did you feel like a bit of a professional when they were showing you how to plant it today?
A little bit.
Nice. Very cool. Is that the first time you've ever planted cane before?
Yeah. I helped my grandparents a bit out up there on their cane farm.
What did you find interesting about planting the cane this morning?
Oh, probably digging up the rows, how deep we had to go.
Why do you think it's important to learn about sugarcane in school?
because we're surrounded by cane. There's cane everywhere in Mackay.
And do you reckon you got a chance at winning the competition?
Yeah, I'd reckon so.
I'd reckon maybe. Good chance there. That story from Liam McNally. It is 6 minutes to one.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
The outback can be a harsh terrain. The people in the landscape endure drought and flood and drought again. But generations of people in the outback have taken comfort in their gardens. As Grace Nakamura discovered, it's a way to prove that life can thrive, even in the toughest of terrains, and grow into something beautiful.
My goodness, the women out here, they can produce the most sensational gardens in very difficult soil. We have very alkaline soil, sometimes with little to no water, but they keep pulling it off. And you go out to most properties and there's a garden. It's like a little oasis in the middle of it all.
Growing flowers is an act of joy for Outback resident Suzanne Stanton.
Marigolds here because they just make you happy.
The 56-year-old quit her job in aged care a few months ago so she could start a micro flower farm behind her house in Ilfracombe, more than 1,000 kilometres west of Brisbane.
And I wanted to do something that was just for me. I love being outdoors. I love being in amongst the dirt and the manure. It's about bringing joy, firstly to myself and to my husband, but it's also joy for the community.
Walking through blooming beds of yellow and pink and lavender, Suzanne's garden is in stark contrast to the endless plain of straw-coloured Mitchell grass that surrounds it. Suzanne knows this type of country well, having grown up on a cattle station near Longreach.
As a child, I went through a number of droughts, and life on the land it's wonderful on one hand, but incredibly hard on another. Just having gone through it as a family, experiencing the ups and the downs, but there's something about being out here. It's incredibly freeing. My grandmother, years and years and years ago, always had annuals every winter. And so I grew up with that love for the smell of that annual.
Can we go for a little wander?
Yes, we can. So we've got zinnias, which are just starting to poke their little heads out here.
Suzanne is working 7 days a week tending to the flower farm. There's no set prices on any of the flowers. All she asks for is an optional donation, and anyone can pick and cut their own bouquet.
I want it to be affordable for everybody because, you know, usually people have business plans and this and that. And I went, no, just joy. And one young girl came and she was literally jumping for joy between the beds. It was the most extraordinarily beautiful moment. I just stood and laughed and went, wow. Aren't I the luckiest? That's everything to me. That's my payment, really.
Summer is the hardest time of the year for outback gardeners. Temperatures soar into the high 40s and the sun scorches everything that's not undercover. Longreach local Elizabeth Clark wrote a book on outback gardening inspired by her years living through drought.
I wrote the book during the drought because I was fed up and I had plenty to do, but at night I used to sit and worry about things and I thought, I'll just write this down, so I did.
The book title is called Only Grow What Grows. Where did that come from?
It came from an old station hand, Terry, who couldn't read or write, but she had a lovely garden. And I asked her one day why her garden was so good and mine wasn't. She looked at me pityingly and she said, love, I only grow what grows. And I thought that was a good title.
What are some of the differences of planting flowers in a place like Longreach or in the Central West compared to if you're planting them in Brisbane or on the coast?
I think it'd be heaven down on the coast. You got water and you don't have the hot, dry winds. But just pick what suits you. You can't grow, you can't grow camellias out here, but you can grow other things that people can't grow on the coast. Just hardy things like petunias, gazanias.
Ms. Clark has some hard-won advice for budding gardeners.
Best thing is get your soil tested before you start. It does save a lot of heartbreak. I know it's a pain in the neck doing it. So water early in the morning and in the evening, not during the middle of the day. It just burns everything. You think you're being kind, but I don't think it works.
Susan Stanton from Ilfracombe in Western Queensland, ending that report from Grace Nakamura. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. Tomorrow you'll have Madeline McCosker on deck presenting, and then Wednesday and Thursday this week I will be with you at the National Farmers Federation Conference that is on the Gold Coast this week. I'll be presenting the show there Wednesday and Thursday. News time now. It is 1 o'clock.